This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
And it's actually in some ways true. It's true in the sense that it's the foundational text. It's true in the sense that it's also like the Constitution is to the United States. It's the book that gives the institution its authority. Unlike the Constitution and unlike the Bible, the authority of the DSM comes not from God and not from, you know, the founding fathers. It comes from, at least presumably, from science. The modern DSM was psychiatry's attempt to rescue itself from a terrible crisis, which they found themselves embedded in the beginning of the 1970s. And so sort of consciously created it as the cornerstone of the profession.
So what was that crisis? Was that kind of the transition from Freudian psychoanalysis and that kind of approach to psychological problems and treatment to a more clinical or more scientific claiming approach? Is that what it was?
The crisis in psychiatry was caused in part by some embarrassing studies that showed that psychiatrists, given the same patient, would disagree about what mental illness they had more often than they would agree. So that was one problem. And that was sort of an in-house problem that bothered psychiatrists. But then David Rosenhan did his famous On Being Sane in Insane Places, which was the study showing that, you know, in which graduate students showed up at emergency rooms complaining that they were hearing the word thud in their heads and were promptly admitted, all of them, to different hospitals with diagnoses of schizophrenia. And in some cases had trouble getting back out of the hospital, even though they never did anything more to indicate mental illness. And that study made a big splash. And then in 1973, after years of protest by activists, the APA, American Psychiatric Association, voted to delete homosexuality from the DSM, which was then in its second edition, which was troublesome in many ways, the most obvious of which is, can you really vote a diagnosis off the island? Is that science? So psychiatry was, not for the first time in its existence, under siege, largely because of these questions of what is a mental illness and which mental illnesses exist and how do you know them and so on. And so they had to come up with a way to diagnose people reliably. And so during the 1970s, under the guidance of Robert Spitzer, they learned how to fashion criteria to go along with mental illnesses. So suddenly, instead of a paragraph describing what a mental illness, what, say, major depression or schizophrenia was, suddenly there were 9 criteria for depression, and I think it's 6 criteria for schizophrenia, and so on. If they did, and their troubles were considered to be clinically significant, then they were said to qualify. They were said to meet the criteria, which was to say they had the disorder. That was the DSM-3, and that was how this approach to diagnosis came about in the first place. Since 1980, there have been a number of revisions of the DSM, and every time they revise it, there's new fights. And if you look at it from the if you just ask the question, did it work, the answer is it worked brilliantly. Psychiatry went from being a backwater and held in disregard by many doctors and other specialties, came back toward the mainstream. In addition, it regained the confidence of important funding sources like insurance companies and government, the National Institute of Health, all by virtue of having been able to claim that they had made diagnosis reliable. What they hadn't done, and this is really important, is they had shown that doctors could agree that this group of symptoms added up to that disorder, but they hadn't proved that the disorders existed. So while they had shown that the diagnoses were reliable, that they could be agreed upon, they hadn't shown that they were diagnoses of anything.
So when the in the clinical trial, the doctor is asking you, have you been sad? Have you had these feelings? Have you had these thoughts? And comes up with this idea that you're, you know, have clinically depressed. It doesn't really mean anything for you personally. It's just a sort of observation from the outside.
It actually meant surprisingly a lot to me. Because even though I was very skeptical already, I mean, I've been years in this field, and this wasn't the first time I'd written about psychiatry. It certainly wasn't the first project in which I'd wondered about the disorders. It still had an effect on me to be told, you know, you qualify for this disorder. And at that time, this was 2007, the idea that depression in particular was the chemical imbalance had really taken hold. So even though I was very skeptical of that, I started wondering, well, I wonder if I do have a chemical imbalance, because I do struggle with moodiness. And I mean, ask my wife, she'll tell you. I can be pretty moody. I can get pretty low. And, you know, suddenly I'm wondering, at the age of whatever I was at the time, 50, have I lived my life with an unnecessary amount of suffering because there's something wrong with my brain?
That's a huge, huge question that people face. Is this something that, you know, could have been treated, should be treated, because it's a physical limitation that I have? And I think that is an appeal to taking psychiatric medications or getting that test and getting that diagnosis. What do you think about that now? Did you take a look at that, about the biochemical, the claim that there's a biochemical basis, that there's an imbalance, that there are people who actually have disordered brains, and it's only right and only human to give them medical treatment for this medical physical disorder that they have?
Well, what I would say about that is that there's no doubt that the brain, like any other organ in the body, can go bad. I mean, why wouldn't it be able to, right? It's the most complicated organ in the body. You might even say it's more likely to go bad. But that, I don't believe that that accounts for all of the suffering. There are many ways that a person can come to feel depressed, and one of them may have to do with brain pathology. But the problem is that at the moment, anyway, psychiatry can't distinguish between those disorders that are caused, or people with the disorders whose trouble is caused by something going on in their brain that's analogous to, I don't know, diabetes or cancer or something like that, and people whose suffering simply resembles the organic pathology. But what they do is they simply gloss over that possible distinction. One of the things that the DSM-3 did, and continues right through DSM-5, is it just said, we're not going to say anything about, the psychiatrist wrote it, said, we're not going to say anything about what causes these disorders or what the nature of them is. We're simply going to say, these are the symptoms, and if you have the symptoms and they're clinically significant, then you have the disorder. They've washed their hands of the whole question, which on the one hand, you understand that makes some sense, and at the same time, it's ridiculous, because what it means is that anybody with those symptoms has this disorder. And the assumption behind all of this, whether it's stated or not, is that these are brain disorders, and someday we'll find out exactly what's wrong with the brain that's making you be this way. So you asked the question of what was my investigation of this question. So I did a lot of research into the question of where did this idea of depression as a biochemical imbalance come from. And what I discovered was that it's a myth. It's a very carefully constructed myth. And I'm not trying to say there's a conspiracy here. It's just that doctors are so bound and determined to find organic pathology, biochemical imbalances behind depression, that they just assume it's there and therefore they see it.
You're also not saying that the experience of suffering or of pain is a myth. You're saying that the claim that there's a biological cause and a chemical imbalance, that's the myth.
Yeah, I mean, look, obviously anything that happens that has to do with consciousness is impossible without certain biochemical events. It would be crazy, or something like crazy, to say otherwise. It would be like insisting that the sun circles the earth, you know? But what does that mean exactly? Is the brain event the necessary and sufficient condition for the suffering? I'm not sure. I know it's the necessary condition. But, you know, maybe the brain is serving something else. Maybe there's such a thing as a mind. So, yeah, I'm not saying that the brain events don't exist or that they're not important. I'm just saying that they're not the only thing that we should be looking at. And more important, we don't know what those brain events are, even though at this moment you and I are talking. I guarantee you, somewhere in some doctor's office, somewhere in this country, a doctor is telling a patient that they have a chemical imbalance in their brain and that that's why they should take their Abilify, or that's why they should take Prozac. And that very same doctor, if he goes to a medical conference, will certainly talk to his, if a colleague asks him, hey, what about that chemical imbalance? He's going to say, well, no, there isn't. We don't know if there's a chemical imbalance, because they don't. The idea that serotonin deficiencies cause depression, which comes from the fact that the drugs affect serotonin metabolism, is absolutely incorrect. Everybody knows that. It's not serotonin deficiencies. It may not even be serotonin metabolism. It may be what happens as a result of altering serotonin metabolism in the brain that creates the effect of antidepressants. Mm-hmm. The brain's way too complicated for these simplistic explanations.
And I think the other claim of that is that, well, you know, the antidepressant drugs work because they correct chemical imbalances. There's this disease or this disorder or this these levels of chemicals are off balance, and that's how the drugs work. Well, actually, that's you can't demonstrate that chemically either. That's not why do some people find medications useful, for example.
Yes, and exactly. And indeed, if that were the case, you would expect a much more robust effect of these drugs. They aren't very effective, and it's been very difficult for them, for the drug companies, to prove efficacy in clinical trials. So yeah, clearly that's a myth, and that's a lot of what manufacturing depression is about.
If you're just tuning in, this is Madness Radio. We're speaking with Gary Greenberg. Gary is a therapist and author. He's a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine, and he's written for Rolling Stone, The New Yorker, and The New York Times. He is the author of Manufacturing Depression, and his new book is called The Book of Woe, The DSM and the Unmaking of Psychiatry. Because I think that when we talk about this question of, well, do these biological diseases, disorders actually exist, people tend to think that, well, we're claiming that suffering isn't real or that people don't need help on the one hand, but it's not at all. I mean, extreme human suffering can certainly exist without it saying that it's a biological cause or that it can be simply explained away by a chemical imbalance. And I think the other thing that happens is that people think, well, you're claiming that medications aren't helpful to people. Well, actually, clearly, obviously, many, many people take medications and find them and experience them as helpful. Many people don't have the opposite experience. But that doesn't mean that the explanation for why it's helpful is can be reduced to this biological point of view or biological causality.
I talk a lot about pediatric bipolar because that's probably the biggest psychiatric scandal of our generation, you know, recent years, which actually has not that much to do with the DSM, except for one thing. The DSM gives clinicians so much flexibility in terms of diagnosing mental illness that it was possible, despite the fact that if you look at the criteria for bipolar disorder, it's virtually impossible to diagnose a child with bipolar disorder. It doesn't say you can't, but it's very difficult to justify that diagnosis because bipolar disorder requires episodic mania. And children, most of them haven't lived long enough to have episodic mania. And it's very rarely observed in children. That's why prior to the advent of this idea about pediatric bipolar, there was so little of it. But the DSM offers you this incredibly generous loophole called NOS, not otherwise specified. And so there is a diagnosis called bipolar disorder, NOS. And that's what children were diagnosed with. So one of the things that psychiatrists are surprisingly, apparently uninformed about, or at least aren't aware of, is that the effect that a diagnosis has on people's identity. Psychiatrists are very good at understanding the problem of stigma. And they have, to their credit, tried to do things to make stigma less. They've done advocacy and so on. They work with various groups to try to make that burden of diagnosis reduced. But they don't seem to understand that when you get a diagnosis, particularly of a lifelong disorder like bipolar disorder, that it changes the way you think about yourself. It becomes your identity. This is most pronounced not with bipolar, but with Asperger's. Now, Asperger's in the DSM-5 will be eliminated. And one thing that took the APA by surprise was the number of people who wrote in and said, essentially, how dare you take away our identities? They didn't seem to realize that when you tell somebody that this is what you have, you're also telling them, at least sometimes, this is what you are. And that's a function of diagnosis that is very rarely taken into account, I'm afraid.
So, Gary, you're a practicing therapist, and you described yourself as being more on the side of seeing psychotherapy as an art form and not so much as this kind of DSM-oriented scientific objectivity endeavor. Tell us about what is your vision of how we should be responding to human suffering and how we should consider the mind and the heart and people's efforts to try and live a good life or deal with the experiences that they're going through that are emotionally painful or emotionally difficult?
Well, you know, therapy is what we have left now that religion has been more or less obliterated. And so in some ways, it's one of the things that we have left. And in some ways, you have to look at it as sort of what we're stuck with and make the most of it. So to me, what therapy does is intimately tied to the way our society is organized. What therapy does is it provides the opportunity for people to sit down and focus on questions that otherwise we don't have the time, the energy, or the inclination to focus on. Like, what's the meaning and purpose of a life? Why do I treat people in the way that I do? How should I treat people? How should I treat myself? What should my relationship be with the rest of my society? And so on. And to me, the basis of that relationship is the relationship. It's what happens in that very intimate setting of an hour looking at each other and talking to each other. It's actually not that complicated. Now, does any of that have anything to do with healthcare? I really don't know.
And I guess the huge difference is that when you go to a minister, their value system, their morals, their theological, spiritual beliefs are like right there on the table. But the psychotherapist often stands in this place of objectivity and common sense and science and medicine. And so there isn't actual a recognition of the value and the morality that's at play in that relationship.
That's exactly right. The ideology is concealed unless the therapist chooses for it not to be, which I do. I mean, of course, I tell people what I believe. And you know, I don't try to tell them, look, this isn't healthy for you to do. I say that once in a while if I really believe it. But I'm pretty careful to tell people that this is what I believe and this is where my reaction is coming from. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's only a belief that you have to be accountable for how you come across to others. And sometimes it's a belief about how we ought to act in the world in general. So, but you're correct that in general, psychotherapy's ideology is concealed, and it may differ vastly from one therapist to another. When therapists rely on medicine or science to sort of take that whole question off the table, well, I'm a practitioner of a scientific practice here, I think they're doing everybody a disservice.
One of the things that we're seeing with the DSM-5 is this eruption of this huge battle, this war inside the politics of it, with some of the real promoters of the DSM now questioning some of the things that they've been promoting. And what do you see the future of the DSM as? Where is psychiatry headed? Because the battles that have emerged with the DSM-5 have been really huge, and they've been quite public, and there's more of a greater recognition now, I think, that this is a political document, not just a scientific document.
I think that actually that the extent of controversy over the DSM is not necessarily going to clue the general public into how political the document is, at least not in a larger sense. It will be very clear to people when they read my book or the other stuff that's going to get written about the DSM that there are politics that take place, that all the politicking that goes on behind the scenes to create the disorders and the criteria. But the big picture politics, the ones whereby the DSM becomes a moral document, I think that's going to stay pretty hidden. I also think that these wars may end up only suggesting that this particular crew of psychiatrists who created the DSM-5 are a uniquely incompetent bunch, which they are. I mean, I have to admit that while I don't believe that that is the entire explanation for what went wrong, the stupidity and the incompetence and the outright idiocy of some of the things that they did is astonishing.
Give us a couple of examples of that, Gary, because I know there's some pretty serious stories out there.
This whole business with eliminating the bereavement exclusion. There's an exclusion in the DSM-4 for the depression diagnosis because so many people who are grieving meet the criteria for depression. There's an exclusion that says you have to, if a clinician can't diagnose depression if a person has been recently bereaved within 2 months. They're taking that out. Now, I could go into the story of why that's happening, but just on the face of it, how stupid is that? They're going to turn around with a public that's already skeptical of psychiatry and say, okay, you lost your wife, and after 2 weeks, if you meet the criteria for major depression, you have a mental disorder? I mean, why would you do that? There's nothing to stop a doctor from providing medication to a person whose wife died yesterday, let alone 2 weeks ago, if they feel that their patient is and the patient wants it, and they, you know, whatever. That's the doctor's role. You don't need a diagnosis of depression to do that. 72% of antidepressant prescriptions are written without a diagnosis. So the only thing that they're doing there is they're getting rid of an embarrassing thing, because if you put that exclusion into the DSM, in the first place, then people will and have raised the question, well, what about unemployment? What about foreclosure? What about something, divorce? And the answer to that question is there's no reason not to have those other stressors in there. And they can't go back to the old days when they cared about why you had your mental disorder. So they're stuck between a rock and a hard place, but they should have left it alone because the solution is worse than the problem. Okay, so that's an example.
Is there another quick example about some of the stupid things that the DSM is going to be presenting us with?
The decision to remove Asperger's was poorly considered because of what I mentioned before, which is that they didn't take into account that people would be upset that they would lose their identities. Now, how could they not know that?
Gary, we're just about out of time with the interview. Tell us again the name of your book that's coming out and also how people can get in touch with you if they want to find out more information about manufacturing depression, your other book, and your writings and your work.
My most recent book is The Book of Woe, The DSM and the Unmaking of Psychiatry. It's an account of the making of the DSM-5 in its historical context. And everything that I've written, more or less, is on my website, which is GaryGreenbergOnline.com, and my books can be ordered there too.
Gary Greenberg, thank you for joining us today on Madness Radio.
It's my pleasure.
You've been listening to an interview with Gary Greenberg. He's a therapist and author, contributing editor at Harper's Magazine, and he's written for Rolling Stone, The New Yorker, and The New York Times. He's the author of Manufacturing Depression, and his most recent book is called The Book of Woe, The DSM and the Unmaking of Psychiatry. That's all the time we have on Madness Radio. Thanks for tuning in. You've been listening to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health, co-sponsored by the Icarus Project, Portland Hearing Voices, and Freedom Center. Madness Radio is hosted by Will Hall, and producer is Leah Harris. Madness Radio is based at KBOO in Oregon and can be heard on FM stations on the Pacifica Radio Network. Listen on the internet at madnessradio.net and on iTunes. Contact us at radio@madnessradio.net.
If you are interested in country western music, tune in Saturday mornings from 6 to 9 a.m. for Swingin' Country on KBOO 90.7 in Portland, Oregon. That's Swingin' Country, 6 to 9 a.m. every Saturday morning.
Hi, this is Dwight Yoakam saying happy birthday to you, K-Boo, on your 45th.
It is 12 o'clock, just seconds before, and you're tuned to KBOO in Portland, 90.7 FM.
And now the KBOO News at Noon. The city of Portland has decided to give up its fight to keep its reservoirs uncovered. For years, the city has tried to argue that a federal mandate to cover all reservoirs in the nation should not apply to Portland, since the city gets its water from the pristine Bull Run watershed. The city of New York fought for and received a variance allowing them to avoid covering their reservoirs. But Portland did not get a variance, and the city's Water Bureau has not taken steps to challenge the federal mandate. Some estimates put the cost of covering the reservoirs at up to $30 million. In the Oregon State Legislature today, the Senate is considering a bill that would allow employees to take up to 2 weeks of unpaid bereavement leave under existing state leave policies. Also under consideration in the Oregon House today is a bill expanding the list of people who must report incidents of elder abuse to authorities, and a bill which would prohibit private and public colleges, universities, and so on from requiring or otherwise compelling students and prospective students to share social media passwords. A similar bill regarding employers demanding employees' social media passwords passed the House last week. In national news, the military court-martial of Army Private Bradley Manning begins today in Fort Meade, Maryland. His supporters stage protests throughout the weekend and continuing through today. Manning is currently facing a military tribunal for his connection to massive leaks of Afghan and Iraqi war documents, U.S. diplomatic cables, and classified videos to the transparency group WikiLeaks. Manning's year-long pretrial has been criticized for press restrictions that have made covering the case extremely difficult for reporters. If convicted on all counts, Manning could face life in prison. The U.S. Supreme Court has ordered the cases of six Texas death row inmates reviewed. The rulings come on the heels of last week's decision by the court that another Texas inmate had been misrepresented by counsel on appeal. The court also issued a ruling that police may now conduct routine DNA testing on people who are arrested even before they are charged with any crime. Dissenting Justice Antonin Scalia argued that the tests represented a major enhancement of police powers and that allowing the taking of the DNA swabs prior to conviction and without a judge's warrant represented an unreasonable search that violates the Fourth Amendment. That's the KBOO News at Noon. For more local, national, and international news, tune in every evening at 5 for the KBOO Evening News, produced by volunteer reporters right here in our Portland studios. For KBOO, I'm Jimmy Tardy. This is KBOO Portland.
And it is KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. This is the Noontime Jamboree, and I'm Retta Christie in. Today, this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Aladdin Theater, presenting singer-songwriter James McMurtry, Wednesday, June 19th at 8 p.m. Tickets and information for James McMurtry on June 19th are at the Aladdin box office or aladdin-theater.com. Thank you. Well, starting off the noontime jamboree today with some Red Nickles, and I wouldn't be where I am if you hadn't gone away. Yes, right here on the noontime jamboree, where it's 12:04. I'm Retta Christie in with a bunch of music that I just brought a mishmash of things in. And as Tom, the engineer, said, it's mostly stuck in the 1940s, which is probably true. However, this is the 1950s, I do believe. The Leuven Brothers and Cash on the Barrelhead.
Got in a little trouble at the county seat. Lord, they put me in the jailhouse for loafing on the street. When the judge heard the verdict, I was a guilty man. He said $45 or 30 days in the can. That'll be cash on the Barrelhead, son. You can take your choice, you're 21. Money down, no credit plan, no time to chase you, 'cause I'm a busy man. Good-hearted jailer with a six-gun hip. He let me call long distance. She said, number, please. And no sooner than I told her, she shouted out at me. That'll be cash on the Barrelhead, son. Not part, not half, but the entire sum. Traveling